Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, and it's Thursday the 13th, and this is the second lecture on nervous system, neurophysiology. And before I ask for some questions about what we covered last time, let's look at the schedule. And it's shown on the right-hand side. I guess I'm going to turn some of these lights down, like so, so, like that. Is that too dark? Oh, you ladies are going to have to share that with us. You've been laughing a lot back there. I might need something to laugh at in a little bit. Okay, so the schedule. 13th, yep, here it says nervous system, neurons and synapses 2. That's chapter 7, and chapter 7 will be on the test. So the question is, when is the next test? It's going to be on a Tuesday, but not the Tuesday that's coming right up. It's going to be on March 25th. So today is the 13th. And so it's about a week and a half away, right? And Tuesday, the 25th of March. The chapters are only 4, 5, and 7, but that's okay with me. Only 3 chapters. Here's the sign-in sheet. Go ahead, sign, and pass it around. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule? You're pretty good with the schedule? All right, so hopefully you all have printed out your study guides for these 3 chapters so you can get a sense of how much time you're going to have to spend to accomplish all those things in the study guide. And if there's a problem, make sure you let me know. All right, so what were we talking about last time? Probably the major concept was resting membrane potential. Was that it? Resting membrane potential. We started there, but then we jumped off from resting membrane potential and started talking about action potential and action potential. And just like resting membrane potential, sodium and potassium are very important for maintaining RMP. What about an action potential? Does action potential require sodium and potassium? Absolutely. So you got to be really familiar with that. So what are the two main phases of an action potential? Two main phases. Depolarization and repolarization. What happens first? Yeah, depolarization. And you should know what ion is responsible for that. That's sodium. And which way is it moving? It's going across the membrane. That's a hint. Which way is it moving? It's moving inside the cell. So the inside of the cell becomes positive, more positive when that happens. Right? And so that is depolarization. You said the second phase is repolarization. And is sodium responsible for repolarization? Oh, I agree. It's not. What is? It is potassium. And which way does potassium go for repolarization? It goes out. And remember, potassium is a cation. When it leaves the cell, the inside of the cell becomes more negative as a result. All right, so next week, you're going to be. I want you to draw this illustration right here of an action potential. I'll send it out. And so just make sure you can draw that action potential out. What is the strange thing about this action potential, especially this initial very steep rise of sodium in terms of homeostasis? What's really kind of interesting about this? Because action potentials take place all the time in our body, right? So what is very interesting about the sodium entering the cell and this ascending limb of an action potential? What kind of feedback is required? Yeah, positive feedback is required, right? And that's very unusual, right? Positive feedback is not used to maintain homeostasis. And positive feedback can't happen for a long period of time because something's going to break or blow up. So what stops that positive feedback from occurring? Okay. See, I don't want to look bigger. I want to go back. That's it. What stops that positive feedback from occurring? The inactivation gate closes, right? The inactivation gate closes, and then that takes us to the peak of the action potential. That's when sodium can no longer enter the cell, right? So that positive feedback mechanism stops as a result of that. Okay, so that's action potential. And so you know some of the mechanics of an action potential. And there's a lot we need to talk about in action potential, and that is, I want to show you, we went over that. Here I have 3 action potentials. All right, and what can you tell me about the amplitude of these three action potentials? Are they different? They're the same. What about the duration of the first one and the duration of the second, duration of the third? Exactly the same. And so from that, I just want you to know that all action potentials are what? Are the same or identical. Okay, they're always going to be identical. And this is, an action potential is the language of the nervous system. This is how neurons communicate with each other. So if you were to listen to your brain, you wouldn't hear like English or some other language taking place or music up there. Your brain only speaks to itself and with other neurons in terms of this blip. All right, so here's a blip, there's a blip, and here's a blip. And it's the frequency of these blips that makes sense, right? Okay, because every action potential is the same. And can you picture where an axon hillock is? Where's an axon hillock? It's right next to the cell body, right? And that's where an action potential begins, and then it's going to flow all the way down the axon. What's the difference in the action potential that's initiated at the axon hillock and an action potential that's way down by the axon terminus, even if it's a meter away? What's the difference in action potentials there? Because it's really far away. What's the difference? There's absolutely no difference. That's what's so amazing about neurons. They don't lose that action potential signal. We say that action potentials then travel without decrement. Without decrement. They don't die away. They just go forever and ever. And if you had a nerve fiber that went from here to the moon, and there was an action potential going across, what would be the action potential here on Earth compared to the action potential on the moon? Exactly the same. Yeah, so that's pretty amazing that our neurons do not lose signal. No, there's no other mechanism, no other way that we can do that, right? If we're going to send a radio signal, it would get weaker and weaker and weaker by the time it got to the moon. Action potential does not. Okay, and so we call that traveling without decrement. Now, what kind of sodium and potassium, we said, move across the membrane, but generally they can't because they're ions. What allows them to move across the membrane for an action potential? There's a channel. Yeah, there's some kind of channel, and you got to know something about that channel. How does that channel know when to open and close? It's based on the voltage of the membrane. So we call these what? Voltage-gated channels. And so to get an action potential started, you have to do something to the voltage on that membrane. All right, and so we call that a stimulus. A stimulus is going to be a depolarization. And if that stimulus is great enough to reach the threshold voltage, then sodium channels are going to open up. Right, and that's going to cause more depolarization, which then opens more sodium channels, which causes more depolarization, which opens more sodium channels. What does that sound like? Positive feedback. Yeah, that's nice positive feedback. And then that positive feedback stops right here because that inactivation gate closes at the peak of that action potential. Right, and that is the voltage-gated sodium channel. There are voltage-gated potassium channels that open up, but they're slower, and you can see that they're slower on this slide right here. The first curve represents permeability of sodium across the membrane. The second curve is for potassium, and that's because the potassium channels open up much more slowly. That's why they're involved with repolarization on the second phase of an action potential. Okay, but remember, action potential is always going to be the same. So we say they propagate without decrement. All right, now where do we have these voltage-gated channels? They're in the plasma membrane, but what are the three parts? What's the three parts of a neuron? Three parts. If we're going to take a neuron and break it down into three parts, we would start with a dendrite. That's the receiving end, right? And then the cell body. And then what's the sending end? The axon, that's right. So a neuron sends action potential. So guess what an axon has to have if it sends an action potential? It's got to have voltage-gated sodium channels and voltage-gated potassium channels, right? That's what's necessary for an action potential. The cell body and dendrite cannot send an action potential. They can't even generate an action potential because guess what kind of proteins they're missing in the cell membrane? There are no voltage-gated channels on dendrites or the cell body, and those are what is necessary for an action potential. The first place on a neuron where an electrical signal will bump into a voltage-gated channel is the axon hillock. Sometimes we call that the initial segment of an axon. That's where the cell begins to put voltage-gated channels, and then the cell will place it in the axon all the way to the axon terminus. All right, so voltage-gated channels produce action potentials, but there are other kinds of channels on cell bodies and dendrites that we're going to talk about really, really soon, but we're going to put that off for just a little bit. So what about amplitude? Amplitude of an action potential. Are they going to be constant or are they going to change? Well, you should just be yelling this out right now. They're always going to, it's going to be constant, right? There's no change in action potentials ever, ever, ever. Okay. All right, so voltage-gated channels are found only in the plasma membrane of axons, not dendrites, not cell bodies. So only axons can transmit action potentials as a result of that. All right, so how would you explain this figure right here that we're looking at? What is minus 70 millivolts? I see minus 70 millivolts. So here is a plot of voltage across the cell membrane versus time, for instance. All right, so here we apply a stimulus, maybe at the amplitude of this arrow right here, right, at this point in time. And what does this minus 70 represent? Yeah, resting membrane potential, the cell's at rest. We apply a stimulus to this membrane, and what kind of electrical event is excitatory on a neuron? Is it depolarization or hyperpolarization? Depolarization, right? So the stimulus right here depolarizes the membrane, but what did not happen? That depolarization wasn't enough to reach threshold. All right, so this stimulus right here we call a subthreshold stimulus. It didn't trigger those voltage-gated channels to open up, so no action potential was produced. Well, I still want to see an action potential. So let's turn up the intensity of the stimulus. All right, so does this arrow look longer than the first one? Yeah, the second one is longer. Now, what can you tell me about the second stimulus? Did it reach threshold? Yeah, it did, because now I see an action potential, right? So this is just a nice threshold level stimulus, and we see a nice action potential as a result. All right, and then we're going to let things relax for a little bit, and it's going to go back down to, where is the cursor at right now? Yeah, RMP once again. Ah, but we want to trick this neuron again, so we're going to stimulate it again with what? Even a greater stimulus, right? This arrow looks bigger. We give it a greater stimulus, right? And it produces an action potential because it is a threshold stimulus. All right, now let's compare. What's the difference between the first and second action potential? Nothing. Even though, what could you tell me about the stimulus, the third compared to the second stimulus? Are they the same? No, they're different. All right, so even when the stimulus intensity changes, action potential, amplitude, and duration does not change. They're always going to be the same. All right, then we let the membrane go back down to RMP, and for sure, I want to see a change in action potential. So let's turn the stimulus strength way, way up, as high as we can dial it up, okay? And we see a big, huge stimulus right here. And this is a threshold stimulus because it produced what? An action potential, right? And then what can you tell me about this action potential compared to these first two? Exactly the same. So the stimulus intensity can change, but an action potential does what? Never changes. Yeah, never, never, ever changes. Okay. But I think I demonstrated last time for you that we can appreciate these different intensities of stimulus in our bodies, right? I could talk really softly, and you can hear that I'm talking very softly. Or I could talk really loud, right? And you have an appreciation of that I'm talking loud. But how can that be if these action potentials are always the same amplitude and they're always the same duration? What's happening? How is it that we can experience graded stimuli, very weak and very strong stimuli, and an action potential is always going to be the same? Okay? And the way that what we invoke to explain that is frequency coding. That's the term, frequency coding. So let's look at this graph right here. So here we have a cell at RMP, And we turn a stimulus on, and we leave it on for a period of time, then we turn it off. And during that period of time, it's just a constant amplitude stimulus. Right? And what can you tell me about this stimulus? What kind of stimulus is this? It's weak because it didn't reach threshold, so we call that a sub-threshold stimulus. Right? Here's a sub-threshold stimulus. Can you have that picture of an action potential in your mind? And that initial depolarization is what we call stimulus, and it has to reach that threshold voltage. This one did not. So I don't see any action potentials here. Do you agree? See any action potentials there? Indeed, no. All right, well, let's try again. Let's make the stimulus intensity a little bit greater, maybe double it. So now we double the stimulus intensity, and what can you tell me about this stimulus? Is it sub-threshold? No. Yeah, it's at least a threshold stimulus because it's producing action potentials, right? And what can you tell me about this first action potential compared to the second, compared to the third, compared to the fourth? Exactly the same. Here you can see they're the same amplitude, but they're also the same duration. Nothing is changing about them. And this, so we left the second stimulus on for the exact same period of time as the first one, and the second stimulus produced how many action potentials? Four. Okay. Because there is that refractory period in an action potential where another action potential can't be initiated. Where was that at? Okay. Here it is, right here. This is the refractory period, and this action potential, there's no other action potential that can occur at this location on a neuron because of this refractory period. All right, so let's do one more experiment. Let's double the intensity of that stimulus once again. Let's keep the duration of the stimulus the same. All right, so now it's a higher amplitude, maybe twice the amplitude. We leave it on for the same period of time. Now, what can you tell me about this first action potential from the third stimulus compared to these four over here from the second stimulus? Exactly the same. What about the second action potential compared to the others? The same. And if you look at all of these action potentials here, they're all going to be identical to each other and identical to this threshold stimulus on the left. They're always going to be the same. But do you see a difference? I see a difference in stimulus intensity. Do you see any difference in behavior of the membrane potential from this threshold stimulus compared to this second threshold stimulus? Is there a difference? Indeed, there is, right? As the stimulus intensity increases, the number of action potentials for a certain period of time increases, right? So there is a direct relationship between stimulus intensity and the frequency of action potentials that develop on a neuron. So the stronger the stimulus, the more action potentials can be packed into that certain space. And so we call that frequency coding. All right, so when I'm talking to you very softly, okay, how's your brain talking to itself? It's sending information, right? It's sending information from one hemisphere to another. What's it sending? Because if you listen to it, it's just a blip, right? Action potential. So if I'm talking very softly, your auditory cortex is getting blip, 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 which means what? Really soft, that not a very high intensity stimulus. But now if I start to yell in the room, what do you hear inside your brain? Do you hear a blip, blip, blip? Nope, you hear a blip, 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 right? And your brain is doing that all over the place. Okay, so it talks to each other in terms of these blips, but in reality, what is a blip? It is a action potential. And the frequency of these action potentials determines, right, or brings the information to your brain of what the stimulus intensity is, right? They're directly related to each other. Can you think in that term, directly related? Can you, like, write an equation out for directly related? On either side of the equal mark, you have to have something in the numerator. If one goes up, the other goes up. One goes down, the other goes down. That's a direct relationship. Okay, so increased stimulus intensity causes more action potentials to be generated or fired, right? But the size of an action potential remains constant, the amplitude and duration. All right, so what did we call this? It's not on this slide. We call this frequency coding. Frequency coding. That's what we invoke to explain how an action potential amplitude will always be the same, even if the amplitude of the stimulus changes. Oh, here's that here's that refractory period. All right, there are two kinds of refractory periods that a voltage-gated channel goes through, and we have these on axons of neurons that we're talking about. There's an absolute period, which means that another action potential, no matter what happens, can be started during this period of time, during absolute refractory period. Then, following that, there is a period of time where another action potential can be generated if the stimulus is high enough, if the intensity of the stimulus is high enough, right, another action potential can be initiated. So let's look at these. So where's the absolute refractory period? It's from the start of the action potential, okay, all the way until right at repolarization, it gets back down to RMP. That's an absolute refractory period. So even if the stimulus intensity is super loud, even if I had a megaphone yelling, screaming in class, okay, during that period of time, action potential could never be generated during this absolute refractory period. And that's because of, anybody remember what's that due to? I don't want to flip back all the way. It's that thing that looked like a chain and ball, which was what? Was the inactivation gate, right? The inactivation gate closes that sodium channel and it just can never open up. And when the sodium channel opens up, that causes depolarization, which is what? Excitatory, okay. All right, so at this point in time, when we get back down to RMP, the inactivation gate, or some of them, start to open up. So now here is a period of time, I see a little area of hyperpolarization, where an action potential can be generated, but now what can you tell me about the stimulus? Here it was at the beginning, this was what, a 15 millivolt stimulus to reach threshold, but now if you're over here, what kind of stimulus do you need? A greater stimulus, 15 plus whatever this extra difference is. So you need a higher intensity stimulus, but right, if it is, then you can generate an action potential here. All right, so this slide kind of shows why frequency encoding happens. If the stimulus is very small, then this neuron has to wait all the way over here before an action potential can take place. But if the stimulus is very large, then an action potential can be stimulated way over in this region. Right, so the spacing is really short when the intensity of the signal is high, and the spacing between action potentials gets longer and longer and longer as the intensity of the stimulus diminishes. Okay. So this area of hyperpolarization can be overcome with a super strong stimulus. That's why we call that the relative refractory period. So this is just a time axis. Okay. So that's how frequency coding works. Now, who's got a question about those voltage-gated channels and action potentials and things like that? Anybody have a question? Yes, back there.
Yeah?
Yeah? Yeah, the action potential should be the same. Sometimes what you see, I'd have to look at the experiment, sometimes what you see on a simulation is muscle contraction, and that's not an action potential, that's actually force being produced by a muscle. Okay, so that's not an electrical event, that's a physical event. So if you have a muscle and you stimulate it very slowly, like stimulate it now, it contracts and it relaxes. Stimulate it again, contracts and relaxes. The amount of tension pretty much will be the same. But if you stimulate it very rapidly, like contract, relax, but before it relaxes completely, you stimulate it again, the tension of that muscle does increase. So the tension of a muscle twitch does go higher and higher and higher until it reaches that plateau region. Okay? We call that, when it reaches that plateau region, we call that tetanus. That would be complete tetanus. Were you looking at a muscle or a nerve? It was a nerve. I can't picture it in my mind. Because all action potentials are the same. Are the same. Question?
Yeah, I have a question on slide 38. So what's the answer to question 18? Cannot somebody think about...
Because of absolute refractory period. So you can't have another action potential on top of this first one. Because then it would be what? A higher amplitude. And what can you tell me about action potentials? Always the same amplitude. Right? And the reason why they're always the same amplitude, because they can't happen on top of each other. They cannot summate. Because of that refractory period. Yeah, that's a good one to appreciate. Okay. Yeah, I don't know, we might have to talk about that experiment in lab a little bit. I have to understand what was the simulation was all about. All right, so, and that any other questions? What can you tell me about action potentials? A lot of stuff. Go ahead, tell me something about an action potential that I want to know because it could be on the test. They're all the same, that's right. And what part of a neuron can produce an action potential? Only the axon. Why can only the axon on a neuron produce an action potential? Because only axons have voltage-gated channels. Cell body doesn't, dendrites don't. All right? And when you have an action potential at the axon hillock and it moves all the way to the axon terminus, what's the difference in it, that one action potential at the beginning of the axon compared to the end? Exactly the same. So we say an action potential propagates down an axon how? We say without decrement, right? It just doesn't change. So action potentials travel without decrement, and of course they only travel on an axon because of voltage-gated channels. Okay, let's look at another way that electricity or electrical information can be transmitted through a cell, right? And we're going to call these graded potentials. Action potentials are always the same. Graded potentials are different in intensity, and they can be different in duration. All right, so here we have a plot of voltage versus time, and I see a depolarization, and I see another depolarization, and another one. Are these action potentials? No, because they're changing in amplitude. We call this a graded potential. This is a graded potential, okay? So depending on the stimulus, you'll have a different amplitude of graded potential. These kinds of potentials are not generated with voltage-gated channels because voltage-gated channels always produce action potentials. The kind of channels that produce graded potentials are ligand-gated channels. What the heck does that mean? What is a ligand? Yeah, it's a little tiny molecule that binds to a receptor someplace. So a ligand is that little signaling molecule, right? And the receptor is big compared to the signaling molecule. Okay, and so we could also think of this not just voltage versus time, but voltage versus length along a nerve cell, maybe a dendrite, for instance. So as this electrical signal moves across a nerve cell, what happens to it? Does it stay the same amplitude like an action potential? No, it dies away from the point to where it was initiated. All right, so let's take a look at this. Here is an axon, and you could actually think of this as being a dendrite and even a cell body. Axon maybe is a little misleading because axons have voltage-gated channels, but I don't see any voltage-gated channels on this illustration. So axon probably wouldn't be really good. Let's say dendrite. What is an excitatory event on the cell? Depolarization or hyperpolarization? Depolarization. And in order to depolarize, what do you have to do to the inside of the cell? Make it more positive, right? So this is what we're doing. Here we have a little electrode and we're going to inject something positive, right? Some electrical charge positive into this cell. And that causes a disturbance on the cell membrane that causes a flow of electricity down the dendrite or across the cell body. And the amount of positive charges that we inject into the cell determines the height of this graded potential. And then it starts to move along the cell because the cell has a lot of ions in it. Ions conduct electricity.
Right? But, okay, you guys got a question? I don't know. You might be talking just a little bit too loud right there. Got a good question? You okay? Okay. So here you have that electrical signal flowing through a cell. And the reason why that electrical signal starts to die is because there is resistance to flow of electricity inside the cell. And so that signal disappears. And also some of that electrical signal can leak out of the cell. And when it leaks out, that causes the graded potential to decrease. We call that when current leaks out, right, just through various kinds of ion channels. So the graded potential decreases as it's moving along an axon because of resistance inside and because some of the current can actually leak out of an axon. And then if we go really far away, like to the axon terminus, then there won't even be a graded potential there at all. So when I look at this, I kind of think of a ringing of a bell. If you just hit a bell one time, what happens? What do you hear? Yeah, you hear real loud when you hit the bell, and then what happens? The ringing starts to die away, right? So think of that as like being a graded potential, something totally opposite compared to an action potential. Okay, so this initial injection of positive electricity inside this axon can be done with a channel, right? And this kind of channel would be a ligand-gated channel. Right, so at resting membrane potential, where do you have a high sodium concentration? At RMP. Outside the cell. And so what's the charge inside the cell? Negative. So if all of a sudden we open up a channel for sodium, what's going to happen to the electrical properties of that cell? Yeah, sodium is going to rush in, and then the cell is going to depolarize. Okay. So that channel in particular is not controlled by the voltage across the membrane, but something has to bind to a receptor site on that sodium channel. When a signaling molecule binds to a receptor site on a ligand-gated channel, it opens up, and then what happens? Sodium rushes in, causes depolarization, produces this little bit of a graded signal, and as it moves down the dendrite or cell body, it dies away. Okay, just one last thought. Okay. And then I'll answer some questions. So, a graded potential, unlike an action potential, propagates in what kind of fashion? We said an action potential propagates without decrement. Right? Is that what you said? Without decrement? Okay, action potential propagates without decrement. What about a graded potential? It propagates with decrement, right? It just means it dies away. Questions? The point of this thing here, okay, is that, remember, dendrites are the receiving end of a neuron. And these receiving ends receive information from all over the place, maybe 10,000 other neurons. And that receiving end is going to produce graded potentials. And if the graded potential is a high enough intensity by the time it reaches the axon hillock, guess what can happen? A graded potential can initiate an action potential if the graded potential is high enough in amplitude. Okay, so that's one reason. The other reason we haven't talked about yet, and I'll talk about that right now, can an action potential summate? Can we have one action potential on top of another? We can't, right? But graded potentials, you can. Graded potentials can summate. So if there is one graded potential on a cell, and if it's sub-threshold, it can't trigger an action potential. But let's just say maybe two different locations on that neuron got stimulated to produce a graded potential, and they meet together, they summate, and now the summation of those two graded potentials can trigger an action potential. All right, so what is happening there? Well, when you take information from a number of different places and add it together, what do we call that? Anybody have a math class? We talk about that, like a calculus class? Okay, I'm not so sure. But when you take information from a bunch of different places and add it together, we call that integration. Right, when we take a whole bunch of information together, add it, and to get some a good idea of what's happening, we call that integration. So
So every single neuron acts like an integration center. It can add, what is it adding together? Graded potentials that are generated on dendrites in the cell body. So that's pretty amazing, right? Every cell is an integration center. Yeah. Oh, they can reach a threshold by themselves. Yep. And since they can summate, then yeah, they're added together. And we're going to talk about another little step that's real important too. Sometimes, okay, there is, what do we call this when it causes a depolarization? Is that excitation? This graded potential, is that causing an excitation? Yeah, depolarization is excitatory, okay? But it just so happens it's not threshold, so you don't see an action potential here. Not only can you have a depolarization, but you can have a graded potential that hyperpolarizes the membrane. All right, so what's happening to the cell then when we hyperpolarize the membrane? It becomes inhibited, right? And so if we have a graded potential that is like 10 millivolts positive and another one that's 10 millivolts negative, what does the cell do? It integrates. What's plus 10 and minus 10 together? Zero. Nothing changes. So that neuron then decides with that information not to pass it on to the next neuron. All right, so graded potentials can summate. And if it reaches threshold, then an action potential starts at the axon hillock. And graded potentials can even be negative. We got some special terms for those. I will mention those pretty soon. All right, so here we have a nice neuron. And so the three parts are what? Dendrite, cell body, axon, nice axon terminus. We're going to have to talk a little about that axon terminus in a little bit. But I want you to know the cell body and dendrite, functionally, what part of the neuron is that? What part of the neuron is that? You know, when I look at this neuron right here, I think of a TV set that I used to have. Okay, I don't know if any of you have ever seen a TV set like that, but it was way before the days of cable. So what did a TV set have to have? Antennas, right? So when I look at these dendrites, I think of antennas on my TV set, because what does an antenna do? It receives signals, right? So these dendrites receive signals, right, in the terms of ligands that are coming from other neurons or other neurotransmitters, right? So these dendrites receive signals. The cell body receives signals. So this is the receiving end. This is the receiving end because it has a certain kind of gated channel. The signal is a little chemical molecule that we call a ligand. So these parts of a neuron have ligand-gated channels. Right? They can only produce graded potentials. Ligand-gated channels can't produce action potential. But look at this initial segment right here. I think I asked you, what did the shape of this initial segment of the axon look like? A kitchen utensil. Looks like a funnel, right? And yeah, all those graded potentials are doing what? They get funneled into this initial segment, and the graded potentials, since they can sum, what's happening in that initial segment? All those graded potentials are integrated up, right? And if after that integration, if it reaches threshold, what's going to happen? Action potential will start here. Right? So action potentials start in this initial segment of an axon. And you could think of that as the axon hillock, right? And an action potential starts right here because now instead of having ligand-gated channels, what do you have? You have voltage-gated channels, right? And when this voltage-gated channel gets triggered, that triggers the next one to depolarize, which triggers the next one to depolarize. So an action potential will move down an axon from the axon hillock to the axon terminus. Right? Because this depolarization in one region will cause depolarization in the next, and depolarization in the next, and that wave of action potential moving down an axon, sometimes we call that a nerve impulse. Hi. You know, it can go into the axon. But once it gets into the axon, what happens to it? Okay? Well, I'm thinking of that graded potential in particular. It would die away. It just dies away. It's never high enough amplitude to where it can go from the dendrite all the way down to the axon terminus. It starts to die away even in the dendrite. Dies away even more in the cell body. Right? And by the time it gets into the exon, even in this location, they're probably almost all gone. Okay? So that graded potential isn't used for anything, right, within the axon. Only action potentials are used in an axon. So that was a pretty good question. Just, did that sort of make sense? Sort of. Okay. Well, there's something else that's happening right here. We see that an action potential moves in what direction? Which way is this blue thing moving? From cell body to axon terminus. Right? And so an action potential can only travel in that direction. When you have an action potential starting here, why can't it go back? Why can't it go back? What's happening in an action potential once that inactivation gate closes? So here the inactivation gate closes, sodium can't enter the cell, then this causes a refractory period. So this part of the axon then can't initiate another action potential until a later time. So an action potential can only, in this illustration, go from left to right. It can't go backwards because action potentials only go in one direction. Okay. If there's an action potential moving down this axon, as we see in this diagram right here, it's pretty slow. It's about 2 miles per hour. All of us can walk faster than 2 miles an hour. Right, so that doesn't seem really fast at all. But there is a way to speed up that action potential moving down an axon. If you were going to make an axon, what could you do to it to speed up that rate of the velocity of that nerve impulse or the rate of that action potential moving down an axon? Yeah, you could myelinate it. Okay, and maybe that's the next slide. Ooh, thank goodness. Okay, so I see some myelination right here. Underneath the Schwann cell, let's just say this is a Schwann cell, so what kind of nervous system are we looking at? Yeah, so it's peripheral nervous system. Underneath the Schwann cell, remember, there are no voltage-gated channels, only in the nodes of Ranvier. So if there is, okay, if there was an action potential here that causes a depolarization, and then that depolarization causes that electrical signal to move all the way underneath the Schwann cell, Schwann cell acts as an insulator so the signal can't leak out like we talked about on one of the previous slides. Right, so that potential moves down over here. Now there are voltage-gated channels in this next node of Ranvier, and that reaches threshold which causes another action potential. That electrical signal moves through the next Schwann cell, okay, and to this node of Ranvier which causes an action potential. The movement of this electrical signal underneath the Schwann cell moves pretty much at the speed of light, or whatever the speed of light of is in this medium, which is a salty medium. Right? So what is the speed of light, fast or slow? It's fast, right? That's about as fast as anything can be in our universe. So an action potential is here, travels very fast, causes another action potential, and then travels very fast once again. And so we say that that electrical signal or the action potential actually skips from one node of Ranvier to the other. And the length of this Schwann cell has to match up so that this action potential, when it produces that electrical signal, it doesn't die away to sub-threshold by the time it gets to the next node of Ranvier. And, oh darn, I forgot how long these Schwann cells are. They might be a millimeter. Really long compared to, I mean, you can see a millimeter without a microscope very easily, right? Okay, I might have to look that up. Might be 2 millimeters, somewhere in that range. They're huge cells. So that action potential can skip every couple millimeters down an axon. And when that action potential skips down an axon, it increases the speed from what, 2 miles an hour to as fast as 300 miles per hour. Okay, so what kind of axons would you like to have? Fast or slow? Sounds like one of those commercials that I saw not too long ago. What's better, fast or slow? Well, fast for sure, right? Because if there's a bus coming at you, you don't want to have these neurons relaying information at 2 miles per hour. You would like neurons activating, you know, hundreds of miles per hour so that you could jump out of the way of that bus that's going to crash into you. Okay, and of course that's never a good thing. So when we say action potential skipping down an axon, we call that saltatory conduction. Saltatory conduction, and I hope I have that, yeah, here on this slide, next slide. Saltatory conduction.
What? It is a way of speeding up the transmission of a nerve impulse down an axon because it is myelinated. It just skips right on down. If it is a non-myelinated axon, of course it's slower, but that kind of conduction is what we call continuous. So the two kinds of conduction are continuous versus saltatory. And which one is faster, continuous or saltatory? Yeah, saltatory conduction. But that requires myelination. All right, in some cases, so that myelin is a lipid compound, has a certain kind of structure and shape, and there are antigens on these Schwann cells, and oligodendrocytes also have antigens and myelin in them, and every once in a while, somebody will become sensitized to the shape of those molecules, and their own body then produces antibodies against the myelin sheath, especially in their brain. So what happens to those axons inside their brain? They start to slow down. And the timing of sending signals to various parts of the brain gets all messed up, and we know what that condition is called when we lose myelination of axons. It's called multiple sclerosis. All right, so these myelin Schwann cells turn into plaques, and they can even prevent electrical signals from moving down an axon. The plaques can prevent that from happening. So that's a pretty serious condition. And it can go into remission, and then it can come back, and then go into remission again. Sometimes it's progressive. With medications today, with good treatment, you can live almost a normal life. Yeah. Continuous conduction is just slow. And saltatory is fast. Generally speaking, I like fast. There are some neurons in our body that are not myelinated, and so they're slow. Okay? And I'm thinking of autonomic nervous system. Remember, for autonomic nervous system, it requires two neurons back-to-back to get the effector organ. One of those is non-myelinated, and the other is myelinated. And that autonomic nervous system just happens to be a very ancient form of nervous system. And so it just uses that ancient form of neuron that is not myelinated. Yeah. If I were to choose, I would always pick saltatory. I guess I don't know a reason why having a non-myelinated fiber in an autonomic nervous system, if there is any benefit to that. I don't know if there is a benefit. But there might be because it's there. I haven't thought about it. Okay. So, do you see saltatory conduction right there? And the signal underneath the Schwann cell moves really, really fast. Okay. All right, synaptic transmission. So here is something else. Transmission just means sending a signal from one place to another. And transmission of information, how is information transmitted in an axon? How is information transmitted in an axon? As an action potential, right? Goes from the axon hillock to the axon terminus as an action potential. And you know that it travels without decrement. How is information transmitted in a dendrite in cell body? As a graded potential, right? And it's fast, but it dies away. So it can't go very long distance. Certainly can't go down anywhere near the axon terminus. All right, synaptic transmission is transmitting information between cells. Right, not through an axon, not through a dendrite, not through a cell body, but actually between two cells. So a synapse, I want you to know, as the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. What's the structural and functional unit of life? A cell. Yeah, if you know how cells put together, you know pretty much all of everything life has to offer, right? And what's the structural and functional unit of, we didn't talk about many yet in this class. Here's one, of communication between cells. Well, yep, and that's the synapse. So that synapse, because it has a special function, guess what it has to have? A special kind of structure. Yeah, it's got to have a special structure. So I think we looked at structure a little bit in anatomy, but we're going to look at it in a little bit more detail in physiology. And so a synapse is that unit of communication between cells. There are two kinds of synapses. One is called a chemical synapse, and a chemical synapse relies on a signaling molecule that's released by one cell that is received by
the second cell, by another cell. And there's a space between those cells, and sometimes that space we call the synaptic cleft. There's another kind of synapse that we call an electrical synapse. And in this case, there is no space between the cells. The cell membranes of adjacent cells are touching each other, and there's a way for electrical information to go directly from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next. Right? And that's what we call an electrical synapse. But nonetheless, this is still what? A form of communication between two cells. All right, so here, let's talk about electrical synapses first. Let's talk about a synapse first. What kind of synapse would this one be right here? The cells are touching each other. That's an electrical synapse. All right, but remember, positive charges, negative charges can't get through the membrane, so there has to be a special channel that will allow charges, electrical charge molecules, to move from one cell to the next. And here we have, we call these gap junctions. I think you've heard of gap junctions before. They're made with connexin proteins, and they form a tunnel between cells. So let's excite the top cell. What do we want to, how do we excite this top cell? Okay, do we depolarize it or hyperpolarize it? Depolarize. What's your favorite way of depolarizing? Allowing some sodium to get in, right? Sodium loves to rush in there. Let's open up a sodium channel. Sodium channel runs in. That excites the cell, depolarizes it, right? And as sodium then becomes high concentration in the top cell and still low concentration in the bottom cell, what happens to that sodium? Moves by diffusion from the top cell to the bottom cell. And then what happens to the bottom cell when sodium rushes in? It depolarizes. And is that excitatory or inhibitory? That's excitatory on the cell. When sodium rushes into the bottom cell, then it can rush into the cell next to it, and then the one underneath it, the one underneath that one. So all these cells that are joined together with gap junctions will all be depolarized at the same time. Right? And that's what we call an electrical synapse produced by gap junctions, these tunnels between cells. We don't have gap junctions in skeletal muscle, but I think you know where we have gap junctions. There aren't very many in our body, but we have some in a muscle tissue. What kind of tissue has a gap junction? We have an organ that should operate all at one time. All the cells should depolarize at one time. Yeah, your heart, right? Intercalated discs have gap junctions. You've looked at those, I'm sure, the intercalated discs. So when one myocardial cell, one heart cell, depolarizes or gets excited, right, to contract, what happens to all the cells of the heart? They depolarize and the heart contracts as a unit. And that's how the heart has to contract in order to pump blood. That's the function of the heart. If one heart, part of the heart contracts and the other is relaxed, then the part that's contracting is just going to pump blood into the side of the heart that's not contracting. It's not going to go through your body. And then if that side relaxes and then the other side of the heart contracts, then it's going to pump blood back to the side that just relaxed again. It's not going to go through your body. So the heart has to contract as a unit, and the way it does that is because it has what kind of synapses? Electrical synapses with gap junctions. Now, should skeletal muscle have gap junctions, like the heart? Like when I reach out to have this cup of coffee right here, take a drink, right? I'm using my biceps, brachii. If all my skeletal muscles had gap junctions and I reached out, what would happen? All my muscles would contract, right? I would never be able to get to my coffee. So I would not be in favor of designing cells like that at all, right? No gap junctions in skeletal muscle. We want it under voluntary control. Okay, so that's the electrical synapse. Here's a good example of a chemical synapse. And here is an axon up over here. So this, we really zoomed into an axon terminus. Here's a little swelling at the end of an axon. And remember, what did we call this thing? We call this a Bouton terminale, terminal button, axon terminus, this little swelling. Right? And so action potential flows down to this axon terminus. Actually, I want to describe actually a little bit more. So here is the cell, which is going to be sending information. What part of a neuron sends information again? What part of a neuron sends information? Axon, yeah. So here's the end of an axon. It's going to be sending information to another neuron. And what part of another neuron will receive that information? A dendrite, yeah. So here we have one cell. Here's an axon terminus. Here's a dendrite of a neighboring cell. You can see a space between them. We call that space the synaptic cleft. There's fluid, interstitial fluid in there. And so here's the synapse. The top cell that's sending information, we call that the presynaptic cell. The cell that is receiving information is the postsynaptic cell. Right, so we got these two cells, and in between them is the synaptic cleft. This cleft is big enough to where electrical signals can't jump across it. If there was, then it would be like a lightning bolt. We don't have any lightning bolts inside our body to do that. So the signal has to be transmitted as a chemical signal. Right, so here is a chemical signal being released by the, what cell is this here? The presynaptic cell releases this chemical into the synaptic cleft. Okay, and that little chemical is what we call a signaling molecule. It will move by diffusion across the synaptic cleft. And what does the postsynaptic cell have to have in order to sense the presence of this signaling molecule? It's got to have a receptor, right? Postsynaptic cell has receptors, right? The presynaptic cell doesn't have receptors, but it has these vesicles with the signaling molecule. That signaling molecule in a neuron is what we call a neurotransmitter, because it's transmitting information across this chemical synapse. So here we have what we call synaptic vesicles that contain neurotransmitter. And do you know any specific names of neurotransmitters? Do you have any favorite neurotransmitters? I hear some floating around. Acetylcholine is one kind of neurotransmitter. Norepinephrine is another one. Serotonin is one. Glutamate is one. There's a whole bunch of them. We might learn certain aspects of our nervous system that rely on one or more specifically of those neurotransmitters. Yeah? Ah, not every ligand is a neurotransmitter, but a neurotransmitter is a ligand because it's a small molecule that will bind to a receptor. Ligand is a very general term. Yeah, we throw that around a lot. Okay, and sometimes it's hard to visualize because we throw it around so much. But a ligand, best way to think of a ligand, is a little tiny molecule that binds to another big molecule like a receptor. And you can think of that place where it binds as like the active site on that receptor or active site on the enzyme. In enzyme catalyzed reactions, we don't talk about those things as being ligands. We talk about them as being substrates. But that's maybe another way of thinking about it. Okay. So we have neurotransmitter in these synaptic vesicles move by diffusion to the postsynaptic cell. They bind to a receptor. And I'll tell you a little something more about that receptor in just a second. But let's talk about events in the axon. So coming down, what kind of electrical signal moves along an axon? Action potentials, right? Because there's voltage-gated channels in this axon. And so that causes big depolarization. In the axon terminus, there are voltage-gated calcium channels. Right? So not just sodium and potassium voltage-gated channels, but calcium voltage-gated channels. So when this part of the membrane depolarizes, which way is calcium going to go? It's going to go in. Why do you think it's going to go in? Because it's always high outside the cell, right? So calcium is going to come in, and that is a messenger entering the cell that is trying to signal to move all these synaptic vesicles over to the presynaptic membrane so that it can secrete this neurotransmitter into the cleft. So how does that happen? Calcium, as it enters the cell, due to that action potential, binds to something called calmodulin. It just is a protein. It's named calmodulin because it binds calcium, and it modulates activity inside the cell. So hence we call that calmodulin. What kind of ion does calmodulin bind to change its behavior? It binds calcium. So you could, in this particular case, you could think of calcium as being a ligand for calmodulin. All right, so here we have some enzymes that are inside the Bouton terminale, a protein kinase, an inactive form of protein kinase. What does a protein kinase do? It runs around doing something. It's running around phosphorylating something, phosphorylating proteins, changing the shape of other molecules inside this Bouton terminale, right? And because a kinase phosphorylates something. This kinase is activated by calmodulin. Calmodulin is only active when calcium is bound to it. Calcium is only in here when there's an action potential coming down the axon. All right, so this kinase runs around. It phosphorylates all kinds of other proteins inside the cell, which end up moving these synaptic vesicles over to this membrane. Ooh, what membrane is this right here? What membrane is this? Ah, what cell is this? That's the presynaptic cell. So here's the presynaptic membrane. That's what releases neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And then they diffuse over here to cause another electrical signal in the postsynaptic membrane. So this is what we call synaptic transmission, when there are physiologic events in one cell causing physiologic events in a neighboring cell through this chemical synapse. All right, so what else is kind of astounding on this particular figure? Having to do with calcium metabolism. What is one disease process, which I think is really strange because it's going to affect all of us if we live long enough? Osteoporosis, right. Okay, but so you need calcium for strong bones. Where else do you need calcium in the proper concentration to maintain homeostasis? Okay, bones for sure. Yeah, I agree with bones. Where else? Okay, did we talk about muscles yet? We haven't really talked about muscles. Oh, yeah, we did. Sarcoplasmic reticulum, that's going to be on the next test, right? So muscle contraction needs calcium. And what else do you need calcium for? For synaptic transmission, so that neurons can communicate with each other, you have to have proper levels of calcium. So again, if you were going to choose to put calcium someplace, where would you put calcium? Around neurons so that your nervous system operates, or in bones to make bones strong? I'd rather have a nervous system. I'd rather have a brain that's working than strong bones, and your body makes that choice as well. Okay? So that's another reason why we lose bone density as we get older, because a lot of other places in your body need that calcium. So the question, we had a question, okay, about ligands binding to something, to this receptor. Now, what kind of receptor system is that on the postsynaptic membrane? It's a kind of receptor, when it binds the neurotransmitter, it will open up a sodium channel. And when that ligand binds to that gated channel that opens up sodium, what happens to the postsynaptic cell? If a sodium channel all of a sudden opens up on this presynaptic membrane, what happens? Yeah, sodium goes in. We call that depolarization. We know that to be excitatory, right? So that's how excitation in the presynaptic neuron moves into the postsynaptic neuron, carried by that signal, the neurotransmitter signal. But of course, the postsynaptic membrane has to have that ligand-gated channel. The ligand then is the neurotransmitter. And that's an example of one could be acetylcholine. All right, so we see how important calcium is in this scheme right here. All right, so let's take a look here. APs travel down axon to depolarize the Bouton terminale. That opens up voltage-gated channels in the Bouton. That activates calmodulin, which then moves through various mechanisms these synaptic vesicles to the postsynaptic membrane, releasing neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. Okay. So we talked about that slide already. Neurotransmitter release, right? Binding of calcium to calmodulin. How does calcium get inside the cell once again? Because there's a voltage-gated calcium channel. Yeah, when the action potential gets down there, the calcium channel opens up, calcium rushes into the Bouton terminale. All right, some other continuing things. All right, so that neurotransmitter, which we can consider a ligand because it's going to bind to receptor, has to diffuse across the synaptic cleft. It binds to receptor proteins on what membrane? The postsynaptic membrane. And it's a ligand-gated channel, so when it binds, it opens up a chemically regulated ion channel. Chemically regulated meaning the chemical is that neurotransmitter. That's what that means. Okay, so if it's a sodium channel, that's going to cause depolarization, right, which is excitatory. If a sodium channel opens, that causes an excitatory postsynaptic potential, an EPSP. Right? It's because excitatory postsynaptic, PS means postsynaptic, you know where the postsynaptic membrane is, right? It's that distal cell. And a potential is what? It is a voltage. Yeah, it's a voltage. And if it's excitatory, what kind of voltage change is this going to be? An EPSP is going to be excitatory or inhibitory? Oh, well, it says in the name, excitatory. So that means what? Depolarization or hyperpolarization? Yeah, it's going to depolarize the membrane. Okay? Well, there are other kinds of ligand-gated channels which will do the opposite. Okay? There might be some ligand-gated channels that once a neurotransmitter binds to them, opens up a potassium channel. So potassium can leave the cell. What happens to membrane potential then when potassium leaves? A positive charge is going to leave the cell. So what happens to the inside of the cell? Becomes more negative. What do we call that? That is, that's called, well, we didn't do an action potential, but you're right, repolarization. But if you had RMP and you remove positive charges, you cause hyperpolarization, right? Hyperpolarization, you have a nice plot of that on that oscilloscope. And is that excitatory? If we hyperpolarize, is that excitatory or inhibitory? That inhibits that particular cell. That's what we call an IPSP. IPSP inhibits the cell because it hyperpolarizes the membrane in the around the synapse. Okay, and then these EPSPs and IPSPs are graded potentials. So what does that mean? What is a graded potential? Can these EPSPs and IPSPs interact with each other? And the answer is yes, because what can they do that action potentials can't? They can sum together, right? If you have a positive one and a negative one, you get zero. You got two positive ones, now you got one that's even bigger, right? If you got two negative ones, right, then you have a really strong inhibiting influence on that cell. Okay, so EPSPs and IPSPs are super important because that helps neurons integrate information up. All right, so graded potentials. EPSPs, IPSPs are graded potentials. They are due to, are they due to voltage-gated channels? No, ligand-gated channels. Something has to bind to them, like a neurotransmitter, for instance. And where do we have ligand-gated channels? Dendrite and neuron cell body, and since they're responding to signaling compounds from other cells, that's why we call dendrites and cell body the receiving end of a neuron, because they have ligand-gated channels. All right, what are some characteristics of graded potentials? Do they always have the same amplitude? No, they have different. They can even be negative, right? So graded potentials are variable in amplitude. And how do they move down a dendrite or across a cell body? They die away, so we say with decrement, right? And when they bump into each other, what happens? They summate, right? They can add together or they can cancel each other out. So does this sound like an action potential? No. It sounds like the kind of the opposite of an action potential, right? And that's just because of the nature of the gated channels on these different parts of a membrane. Well, I got a question here. What does this question say? Ooh, I hate questions. What part of a neuron is the receiving part and why? Oh, we know that. What's the receiving part of a neuron? Dendrite and cell body and why? It has receptors, that's right, for what? For ligand, right? So it's got it has ligand-gated channels, right? Dendrites, cell body have ligand-gated channels, so it's the receiving end of that neuron. What part of, well, so far so good, got 50%. What part of a neuron is the sending part and why? The axon is the sending part, and why is it the sending part? It has voltage-gated channels which can produce action potentials, right? So that's the big deal with ligand-gated channels and voltage-gated channels. They produce different kinds of electrical activity across the cell membrane. All right, so here is a nice neuron. You have a nice drawing of a neuron in your study guide. I don't think I have a picture of it really handy, but it looks something like this. Maybe it's turned on its side. And certainly look at that because it shows you what the sending part of the neuron is, the receiving part, what kind of channels are in different parts of the neuron. All right, and it's also is myelinated, so you can talk about the saltatory conduction. All right, so where voltage-gated channels first develop in the cell membrane is right here in that axon hillock. Right, and so that is the integration center. It can add EPSPs and IPSPs together and then make a decision on what to do. What is the decision based on? Whether that voltage is threshold or not, because that's how neurons think. They think in terms of that voltage. And if it reaches threshold, then this neuron sends an extra potential down to the axon terminus. If those graded potentials, they all summate at this axon hillock and it doesn't reach threshold, then this neuron decides to do nothing. Right? It doesn't send any information along. Okay. So synaptic transmission definitely requires calcium in order for it to happen. And the space between the presynaptic and postsynaptic neuron is the synaptic cleft. So let me read through this. So down an axon, you have an action potential, right, coming down the axon. When it gets to the Bouton terminale, it opens up a voltage-gated calcium channel. Calcium enters the cell, activates calmodulin, which then moves synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane to release neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. That neurotransmitter then moves across the synaptic cleft by diffusion, and the postsynaptic cell then can respond to that neurotransmitter if it has what? The proper kind of receptor for it. If it's the wrong receptor, then it will ignore that signal. And that's what we call a ligand-gated channel, that protein that the neurotransmitter can bind to. And where do we have these ligand-gated channels? Dendrites and cell bodies. And when a ligand binds to a ligand-gated channel, it can produce an EPSP or an IPSP, depending on what kind of channel it is. If it opens up a sodium channel, that's excitatory because it causes depolarization. And if that graded potential, this EPSP, is at threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock, then that triggers another action potential that will go all the way down to the axon terminus of the postsynaptic cell. So that's how that works. All right, here is acetylcholine is an example of what? A neurotransmitter. And a neurotransmitter is just a ligand that can bind. So acetylcholine is a ligand that can bind to a ligand-gated channel that can change the electrical properties of the postsynaptic cell. Acetylcholine just so happens to be the most widely used neurotransmitter. It's used in all neuromuscular junctions between nerves and skeletal muscle. In all somatic motor pathways, acetylcholine is released. Okay, and in some parts of the autonomic nervous system and other parts of the brain as well. And in some ganglia. Okay, acetylcholine, if it's going to bind to a receptor, we say that receptor is cholinergic. Right? If there is an acetylcholine receptor on a cell, we say it is cholinergic. And there are two different kinds. Actually, there are two different major kinds of cholinergic receptors. There are nicotinic and muscarinic. All right, so what binds to a nicotinic receptor or a muscarinic receptor if these are cholinergic? Nicotinic is an example of a cholinergic receptor, so it binds acetylcholine because it's cholinergic, just by definition. All right, and each of these has some subtypes. I don't know if we're going to talk much about these subtypes for acetylcholine, but for some neurotransmitters we will. Right. When acetylcholine binds to receptors, whether they're nicotinic or muscarinic, they can produce IPSPs or EPSPs. If it's an EPSP, it's what? Excitation. If it's IPSP, it is inhibitory. All right, I think we're going to look at... all right, so these ligand-gated channels, I think we talked about this. It has a receptor site as well as an ion channel, which can open or close. Okay, it's open when that neurotransmitter binds to the receptor. All right, here is going to be a kind of cholinergic receptor that you're going to like because it's really nice and simple. So here we see a membrane protein. It goes all the way across the membrane, and we can see it can be in two states. It can be closed or it can be open. And if it's open, sodium can enter the cell. Here's the extracellular fluid. Your cytoplasm, do you see sodium entering the cell when the channel is open? Yes, and when the channels close, sodium cannot enter the cell. So when sodium enters the cell, what kind of event is that? That's depolarization or excitatory for this particular cell. Okay, this is a really nice picture of a nicotinic type receptor. A nicotinic receptor has two binding sites for acetylcholine, and when this receptor binds two acetylcholines, it changes shape so that the channel opens up and sodium rushes in, causing depolarization. Right? So when acetyl binds to this receptor, it causes depolarization. Now, is that going to be an EPSP or an IPSP? That's an EPSP, right? When sodium enters the cell, we're injecting some positive charge inside the cell. And that happens when acetylcholine binds to it. When acetylcholine concentration decreases in the synaptic cleft, it comes off of the receptor, and then the receptor closes. And then the cell will repolarize after that. Okay. All right, so nicotinic type receptors, I think you can memorize that as always producing EPSPs. A nicotinic receptor, a nicotinicholinergic receptor, is always excitatory. Okay, there's another kind of receptor type, and you're sort of familiar with this already. It was an exam figure, a G protein coupled receptor. So G protein coupled receptor has a receptor and a G protein, right, that has those three subunits. Okay, and when it binds a ligand, it activates, right, that G protein, causes dissociation. All right, so let's look at another kind of acetylcholine. So if it's acetylcholine, it's going to be a cholinergic receptor. Here's a cholinergic receptor because it's going to bind acetylcholine. This is the receptor that goes all the way across the cell membrane. And then on the cytoplasmic side, here is the G protein with the alpha, beta, and gamma subunit. When the receptor binds the ligand, namely acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter, this G protein then dissociates, breaks away from the receptor, and this beta and gamma unit can bump into another type of channel. This is a potassium channel, which is normally closed, right? And when the beta and gamma bump into this potassium channel, in this illustration right here, the channel opens up, and then potassium moves out of the cell. And what does that produce when potassium moves out? Hyperpolarization. And is that an EPSP or an IPSP? That's an IPSP, right? So sometimes these G proteins open some channels, causing, if it's a potassium channel, hyperpolarization. Other times it might close the potassium, and that's going to depolarize the cell. So depending on what kind of channel is placed in the membrane, a muscarinic receptor can be excitatory or inhibitory. It all depends. And we're going to look at some examples of this. You're going to really like some of the examples that are inhibitory. You're actually kind of familiar with them already. All right, and as you look at this figure right here, is this an exam figure? Okay, you all should be screaming, yes, it is an exam figure. Okay, so we're close to finishing up. You know, I only have one more slide right here before we get the neurotransmitter, so let me finish this slide. Okay, so we said that acetylcholine right here should live for a very short period of time within the synaptic cleft. So it has to be degraded. The enzyme that degrades acetylcholine is called acetylcholinesterase. How do you know this is an enzyme? Because there's an ASC, and the substrate is acetylcholine. All right, so when the presynaptic cell releases acetylcholine, it could bind to receptor, but it's also being broken down into acetate and choline. You know what acetate is. What is acetate? The best way to think of acetate. You know it from acetyl coenzyme A. How many carbons are in this acetate right here? There are just two, right? And so when this acetylcholine is broken down, then it can't any longer bind to the receptor, and then the action of acetylcholine stops at this particular synapse. Okay, so the important thing here is what inactivates acetylcholine once it's released is acetylcholinesterase. So if we want to mess around with this synapse, if we want to poison this synapse, guess what we can do?
Maybe we want to keep this signal for acetylcholine around for a long period of time. And if it's in the neuromuscular junction, it's going to cause contraction of a muscle. How can we cause massive contraction of skeletal muscle in somebody's body continuously? By inhibiting acetylcholinesterase. Okay, and neurons can be taken over by that same effect. These are typically what's used in nerve gases and insecticide poisons and things like that. Acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. Right, so that once acetylcholine is released, then the postsynaptic cell is just going to be excited for pretty much the duration of the life of that cell. So that's a particularly effective poison. Okay, so that's the last cell, slide. Take a look at those slides again so you can ask me some questions. Okay, and we're going to start with neurotransmitters next time.